Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhurst. Welcome back to another episode. This is our last episode of 2018. We will be back. We'll be back in 2019, I promise. But we're going to take next week off to celebrate Christmas and New Year's. So hopefully this podcast will send us out with a bang in 2018. I have several news articles I'd like to discuss. And as promised last week, I said I had an interview that was today, actually, with Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer. He and I discussed Republican policy agendas. I asked him about particular policy items that might be on the legislative docket this year. So we had a good discussion, I believe. So hopefully you enjoy that. But before we get to the news and to that interview with Jack Whitfer, first, a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
President Donald Trump made policy via Twitter again yesterday. That'd be Wednesday. Today is Thursday. Not enough coffee, apparently. This is not the first time that he's made a policy announcement via Twitter, but this was actually a video that accompanied Twitter, which I'm going to play for you now. He announced a policy decision on Syria, saying that he was going to pull troops home.
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land, and now it's time for our troops to come back home. I get very saddened when I have to write letters or call parents or wives or husbands of soldiers who have been killed, fighting for our country. It's a great honor. We cherish them, but it's heartbreaking. There's no question about it. It's heartbreaking. Now we've won. It's time to come back. They're getting ready. You're going to see them soon. These are great American heroes. These are great heroes of the world because they fought for us, but they've killed ISIS, who hurts the world. And we're proud to have done it. And I'll tell you, they're up there looking down on us. And there is nobody happier or more proud of their families to put them in a position where they've done such good for so many people. So our boys, our young women, our men, they're all coming back, and they're coming back now. We won, and that's the way we want it, and that's the way they want it.
Reaction to his Syria announcement has been mixed. Of course, not surprisingly, Senator Rand Paul, he praised the decision. He's always been an advocate of not going into Syria, not pursuing an interventionist foreign policy. He said yesterday in a release statement, "Today, President Trump announced that we have won the war against ISIS in Syria. Our troops are coming home. Thank you, Mr. President. The Syrian civil war is largely over, but Syria is a mess and desperately needs reconstruction. These sanctions will delay and possibly prevent reconstruction of Syria and the beginning of a healing time. Now is the time for diplomacy. There are many actors, including Russia, Iran, Turkey, the U.S., and others. But this is the time for diplomacy, not for new sanctions. So I object." Objects to sanctions, potential sanctions, but applauded President Trump's announcement that troops would be pulling out of Syria. Then a group of senators, trying to find that in my inbox here. Senators Joni Ernst of Iowa, and then, of course, U.S. Senators Lindsey Graham, Maggie Sheehan, Angus King, Tom Cotton, Marco Rubio, so a bipartisan mix, urged in a joint statement the Trump administration to reconsider withdrawing from U.S. forces from Syria. The senators wrote, quote, "If you decide to follow through with your decision to pull our troops out of Syria, any remnants of ISIS in Syria will surely renew and embolden their efforts in the region. However, ISIS is not the only threat. The brutal dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad continues to weigh heavily upon the Syrian people, and we fear that a withdrawal of our troops may embolden Bashar al-Assad and take further actions to solidify his power. The withdrawal of American presence from Syria also bolsters two other adversaries in the United States, Iran and Russia. As you are aware, both Iran and Russia have used the Syrian conflict as a stage to magnify their influence in the region. Any sign of weakness perceived by Iran or Russia will only result in their increased presence in the region and a decrease in the trust of our partners and allies. Your administration must not repeat the same mistakes that the previous administrations have made and concede to these bad actors." So then I received also a statement from Defense Priorities. We've had staff members from Defense Priorities on the podcast before. They support President Trump's move. This is from Benjamin Friedman, who's their policy director. He said, quote, "If the country embraced the arguments of interventionists like Senators Lindsey Graham, Jack Reed, and Robert Menendez, the United States would never leave Syria. We'd still have hundreds of thousands of troops in Iraq, and U.S. forces would endlessly toil in that region of civil wars, draining U.S. taxpayers to nation build. The United States did not go to Syria to tilt the balance of its civil war, depose Assad, build a new Syria, or establish a Kurdish statelet. The U.S. military was to liberate the territory held by Islamic State. Syria is a poor country in the midst of a civil war, not a strategic prize that heightens rivals' power. The war in Syria, these senators support so energetically, has never been authorized by the body in which they serve." Then, gotta close out something. The New York Times reports, not the most favorable endorsement I would want to see, but Vladimir Putin, Russian President Vladimir Putin, he celebrates the move to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. The New York Times reports, quote, "President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia on Thursday hailed the decision by President Trump to withdraw U.S. forces from Syria, calling it correct because the American troops were not needed. Mr. Putin's praise came a day after Mr. Trump said he was ordering the withdrawal because the United States military had achieved its goal of defeating the Islamic State militant group in Syria. Given the unfinished business on the ground in Syria, however, the move was a surprise to many, including some senior presidential, military, and diplomatic advisors in Washington. The decision has been criticized, even among Republicans, as abandoning Kurdish allies in the face of hostile Turkey and a still dangerous Islamic State, as well as leaving Syria open territory for the geopolitical ambitions of Russia and Iran. Mr. Putin's response came during his annual news conference, a marathon four-hour affair, during which he suggested several times that Mr. Trump was being thwarted by those who did not accept his victory as president. So, Syria's complicated. It's a mess. There are a lot of different moving parts in Syria. I did not support President Obama's intervention into Syria. I think we had a legitimate national security issue, a reason to go in to deal with ISIS. But that doesn't mean we need to stay there long term. I guess the question to pose to those who are opposing this move, when is the deadline? Also, too, shouldn't Congress authorize our involvement? The War Powers Act only gives the president so much authority to send troops in and a deadline. I mean, we need to Congress needs to involve itself, yes or no, on whether troops stay in Syria. They can't just stay in, you know, forever. And I'm not a peacenik. I'm not against all foreign intervention. I think it has a time and a place. I think right now the American public is war weary. I think our military is war weary. I think we have a budget we need to address. I think we have deficits we need to address. We've been in Afghanistan going on 18 years. We need, I guess, those who say no to this, when is the right time to pull out? I don't want a forever presence in the Middle East. I want to support Israel, and I'm okay with even having some permanent bases in the Middle East to help support our allies. But I think we need to have a time in which we, you know, withdraw, military intervention comes to a close. So I don't know if this was the right time. I'm certainly not a fan of policy announcements on Twitter. Also, if he's not consulting his military advisors, that's troubling. I think he needs to talk to people within the administration. Everybody needs to be on the same sheet of music before a policy is announced. But ultimately, I'm not against pulling troops out of Syria. I just hope the timetable is correct. If ISIS is largely defeated on the ground, you know, maybe it is a good time. I agree with defense priorities. We did not go in to pick a side and tip the scales in a Syrian civil war. That shouldn't have been why we went in. We went in to deal with ISIS. If that job is done, then I think it's time for our troops to go home. Not that I want to see, you know, I'm not a fan of Assad, but there are a lot of dictators doing horrible things in a lot of different places, and we as a country have not intervened. So, you know, I think those who support the intervention in Syria and want to see it continue, they need to, you know, the onus is on them to explain themselves as far as what timeline, what's the deadline, what needs to happen on the ground before, you know, we pull our troops out. I don't want to keep troops in to maintain influence in the region. I don't want to keep troops there just to try to push away Russia and Iran. Frankly, keeping troops there, I think, might do the opposite effect of our relationship with some of the Middle Eastern countries. So, you know, this is a difficult thing, but I'm not against pulling troops out. I just hope this was the right time to do it. I'm not entirely sure. Definitely not an expert on this. Moving on, other news, CNN reports Matt Whitaker, who I've had a chance to interview on several occasions. He's the now acting attorney general, but his forever claim to fame will be that he played tight end for the Iowa Hawkeyes. The CNN reports that Whitaker chose not to recuse himself from overseeing Mueller probe. I always want to say Mueller, but ethics official considered it, quote, a close call, unquote. So, from CNN, quote, Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker has opted not to recuse himself from overseeing Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, despite the opinion of a Justice Department ethics official who believed, while a close call, he should step aside, according to a senior department official close to the process. Gotta love these leaks. Going on here, Whitaker, who has previously criticized the investigation, never sought a formal recommendation about whether he needed to recuse, the source said. Instead, he received guidance on his options and the applicable rules over the course of the three meetings with ethics officials and multiple discussions with his own advisors. Ultimately, it was Whitaker's decision, but the view of the ethics officials will likely raise fresh questions for Democrats on Capitol Hill. They always will have questions. Who sounded the alarm about whether he will try to undercut Mueller's work. The ethics officials concluded there was no, and this is the key thing to remember, there was no actual legal conflict presented that would require Whitaker to recuse himself. Again, there was no actual legal conflict presented that would require Whitaker to recuse himself. For example, he does not have a familial member involved in the probe, unlike the situation with former Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Whitaker was not a surrogate for President Donald Trump's campaign. Actually, he didn't endorse anybody this last election cycle. Going on, quote, however, ethics officials noted there could be an appearance of conflict based on Whitaker's past public comments about the investigation. And as the standard is whether a reasonable person would conclude that he couldn't be impartial. The ethics official tasked with dealing with the review described it as a close call whether Whitaker needed to step aside, but believed in his view that Whitaker should recuse himself out of abundance of caution. Look, my view is that, I think Matt Whitaker can oversee the Mueller probe. I don't think, since he is acting attorney general and he has not been confirmed by the Senate, that there should not be any major changes made during his tenure until Mr. Barr, who's nominated to replace Whitaker, is confirmed by the Senate. So on one hand, I don't mind him overseeing and giving Mueller some guidance. On the other hand, I don't want to see major decisions made. But the fact is, Democrats are going to, frankly, they're going to have problems with anybody who oversees the Mueller probe that's not Rodenstein. So, I have a hard time taking this seriously. I have a hard time taking anonymous leaks seriously. I'm kind of sick of the leaky politics out of Washington, D.C. I think this is kind of non-news, honestly. I don't really see anything happening until a new attorney general is confirmed. But here we go. And I like Matt. I trust his judgment, and I think he would do a good job overseeing the Mueller probe. But I don't really think anything's going to be, done, on that. I just don't see it happening. And frankly, I would not be surprised to see the Mueller report come out here fairly soon. So, not a prediction. I'm not a prophet, but I don't see anything happening with the Mueller probe with Whitaker in office. Then the last piece of news I want to highlight: NBC News reports Trump won't sign current short-term funding bill. Paul Ryan says. The House Speaker did not detail what next steps might be ahead of the Friday night deadline for Congress to fund the government and avoid a shutdown. House Speaker Paul Ryan said Thursday afternoon that President Donald Trump had told lawmakers he would not sign the short-term spending bill to fund the government that the Senate passed the night before, as the odds of a shutdown rose sharply. Speaking to reporters outside the White House after a 90-minute meeting he described as productive, Ryan said that Trump would not sign the continuing resolution without provisions that address border security. The wall. We got to fund the wall. that seems to be, it's not just Trump, it's also the Freedom Caucus in the House. That everybody's, the wall is kind of like the line in the sand for this government shutdown. And I don't mind a line in the sand. I don't mind the government being shut down. That doesn't bother me at all. What bothers me is that this is the line that they're choosing, not the funding Planned Parenthood, for instance. Oh, no, we can't shut the government down over funding, abortionists, but we can shut the government down over a border wall, which, frankly, if we build the wall, okay, fine. I think it's mostly a waste of money. I don't think a wall necessarily is needed. I definitely think border security should be bolstered, but I've never been a wall advocate, at least not, well, maybe a wall in some places, but not necessarily a wall along the entire southern border. But, if it happens, it happens. I'm not dead set against it either. So, but That is not the line in the sand I would have drawn. It would have been over Planned Parenthood funding. So that is disappointing. But I say, shut her down. I don't mind the federal government being shut down. I frankly, I think if nothing else we've seen, when the government shuts down, the sky doesn't fall. So, and maybe we'd save some money in the process. Anyway, hey, moving on. Next is my interview with Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer of Ankeny. He played along. You know, I mentioned Matt Whitaker earlier. Whitfer's actually a partner in the law in his, you know, his day job when he's not in the legislature. He's a lawyer, and he serves in the same law firm that Matt Whitaker was the managing partner for. Obviously, Matt had, when he went to the Department of Justice, had to basically retract, I can't remember the formal word for it, but he retracted his partnership, and he's not divested from the partnership. So, but as far as I know, Whitfer's still there. Anyway, what am I trying to say? Well, Whitaker played tight end for the Iowa Hawkeyes. Whitfer was a wide receiver for the Iowa State Cyclones. So he played for the other team, but that's okay. I still like Whitfer anyway. And here's that interview.
Senator Whitfer, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So I just wanted, as we approach 2019 and you guys, the 2019 legislative session will go into session. I guess that's repetitive. But anyway, my main question is, what is your overall agenda? What are some big item issues you hope to see passed? And then we'll drill down into some specific items and topics.
Yeah, in general, we had our second caucus since the election, but our first big caucus talking about issues. And I guess to start, our caucus is really excited and ready to continue what we've started 2 years ago as far as moving the state in the right direction. But I guess the general mission we have is to continue to lead with pro-growth, reform-minded leadership that's made us number one in the country. And those types of reforms that have made us number one, we want to continue that so we stay there. And so there's a lot that goes into that, but that's our overall mission, is to continue that pro-growth, reform-minded leadership. I think when you talk about specific issues that are going to be at the forefront, the two that I would highlight, first of all, would be, we are always going to continue to work to lower the tax burden of Iowans. And we passed the historic income tax bill last year. And not that we're done with that forever, but we just passed that last year. It's going to take a little time to set in and kind of watch how that's working. The next area that the caucus seems excited to work on is property taxes and what we can do in the state of Iowa about getting our specifically residential property taxes at a better level for Iowans.
Yeah, it seems like, I've noticed as a Polk County property taxpayer that, you know, the value of my property just keeps increasing. The taxes haven't been raised necessarily, but the assessor just says, hey, even though you haven't made any significant improvements to your house, value of your house has gone up. So,
that's part of the problem is the people. I think the property tax system is so complicated that it's been developed over decades that citizens here in Polk County and across the state continue to get press releases from the cities, the schools, saying, we lowered your property tax. Shane, we lowered your property tax. It's great. And then all of a sudden you get your bill, your assessments up, and your taxes are actually higher. And this system is something that we want to look at. And I challenged our caucus to continue to think with the reforms in mind and to challenge the status quo, so that just because we've done something for 20 or 30 or 40 years doesn't mean that's how we should continue to do it for the next 20 or 30 years. A lot of these policies and procedures and formulas that are in place to run state government were, one, developed a long time ago, and two, developed with bipartisanship or agreement or compromise that don't always make a lot of sense. They're just kind of mashed together to get everyone on the same page or to at least vote for a bill. That doesn't mean it's the way it should be. And so I've challenged all of our committee chairs to continue to look at everything in state government and underneath their committees to see if there's better ways that we can operate.
Okay. As far as income tax is concerned, One of the concerns I had with the income tax cut that was passed last year was that basically the revenue trigger was set maybe too high before it was going to totally go into effect. Are you guys going to address that, or are you just going to see how revenue is going forward?
Well, there's a lot of different parts to that tax reform bill, and as you may remember, the Senate wanted to be a lot more aggressive in implementing quickly and now and without triggers. But as we tried to find a bill that everyone could agree on and get passed, we decided to put that trigger in there. But you have to remember, with that income tax bill, there's a lot of different moving parts, and I don't know, you know, I would say probably at least 50 to 75% of that is going to, those changes are going to happen regardless of if that trigger is met. The trigger is just one part of that entire bill. So a lot of the reforms we have done are going to phase in over the next 3 years, regardless of whatever happens with the revenue triggers. And so that's a good thing. There is predictability in that, let's just call it 50 to 75% of that bill. The 25% uncertainty is that trigger and whether we hit it or not. I think our caucus would be extremely interested in, at some point, expediting that or saying, you know what, we feel good about where revenues are. We feel good about where the state is. We've constrained our spending to the point where we can just trigger that automatically. So that's a decision for down the road. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we'll address that this year, but it's certainly something that we need to continue to look at.
Okay. Are we, as far as the budgeting process, are there going to be any changes that you hope to see? You know, hopefully that, you know, that'll pass this next session, that'll address how the state of Iowa budgets, how revenue is estimated, how, you know, how are we going to make sure that our budget remains balanced without having to dip into a rainy day fund?
Yeah, I mean, there's been talk about changing how the REC operates and how we get our estimates. I don't know that I've heard the kind of the magic or the silver bullet to figure out, make sure we're never in a situation where revenue doesn't come in as estimated. As you said, there are things that you could do as far as your budgeting principles. One thing that I think is interesting to take a look at is our 99% spending limitation that everyone, a lot of people have heard about. Mm-hmm. It includes not only your ongoing revenue, but also all the money that is built up into your surplus account. So you can spend up to 99% of all the money you have on hand. So to put that in a layperson's perspective, you've saved money over the last 5 years from your job. So you have a savings account, plus you have your annual salary. Under this budgeting principle like the state uses, you could spend all of your salary for the year and all of your savings on ongoing expenses, which is great for that 1 year. And then the next year you come around and there is no money left in that savings account. And so you have built up your ongoing expenses too high. And so should we change that? That's something that I wouldn't mind looking at, to say we're only going to spend 99% of ongoing revenues. And frankly, that's been the practice of the legislature the last few years. Since Governor Branstad won in 2011 and came back as governor and the House Republicans took over, that has been our budgeting principle, is to not spend more than our ongoing revenue, but mm-hmm. the law still says you can spend up to 99% of all your revenue. So that's something that I think we could take a look at.
Okay. As far as you want to have a pro-growth agenda, and I know one of the critiques of our current economic model for the state is that we've lured businesses in with tax credits and tax abatements and with lowering the tax burden for businesses as well as individuals, and someone's saying, are we going to take a look at these tax credits? Will there be any action on addressing some of the tax credits this session?
There will be a lot of conversation about it. I don't know how much will actually get passed in this legislative session.
Maybe we'll see a study group?
Well, when we passed our income tax bill last year, number one, we wanted to focus on the individual income tax rate. And that is because it affects every single Iowan, but it also affects most of our businesses. Most of our businesses don't pay a corporate tax rate. They pay an individual rate, you know, through a pass-through taxation. And so that's where we wanted to put our focus. And instead of addressing corporate last year in that bill, we put language in there that said in the summer of 2019, so here in about, you know, just after this legislative session, we will have a committee come together to review all those tax credits and come back with recommendations on what to do with them. And so that's already in law. That's already going to happen. So I guess the only question left is, do we expedite that and just get to work on it, or do we stick with our original plan? And, you know, that process is, it needs to be thought out. I mean, let's face it, those tax credits were put in by legislators because they were popular and they had the votes to do it. None of them just appeared out of the blue. And so going back and repealing those, you have to do it in a thoughtful way. You need to go and analyze every single one and say, is this program working or is this program not working? And maybe it worked 30 years ago when it was implemented. Maybe it's not working now. I think the governor has started a little bit of that with an announcement she made 2 days ago on her rural economic development plan. And she said, let's change how we allocate the workforce housing credits. You know, houses, the tax credits from building houses where we are in a short supply of housing, but we have needs for our workforce in those areas. And she said, we need to make sure those are focused on rural areas that actually need those to be sustainable. So she's already started looking at some of them, but to really do it in a holistic way, you have to take a lot of time because there's over 40 different tax credit programs. And so we definitely want to take a look at them and do whatever we can to reduce our corporate rate to a system that you don't have to use tax credits to be competitive. It's just flatter, fairer, simpler for everybody.
All right. Are you guys going to pass keep and bear arms resolution for the second year in a row?
Yes, we are. And that's one of our priorities. It's, you know, as you know, and for your listeners, to put something in the Iowa Constitution, it's a fairly lengthy process, as it should be. It shouldn't be easy to change the Constitution, but you have to pass the language in one General Assembly, and then after the election and during the next General Assembly, you need to pass the exact same language, and then it goes to a vote of the people. And so we're at a point where we've already passed it in the last General Assembly. If we get it through this time, you'll likely see it, I don't know for sure, but you'll likely see it on the 2020 ballot. And that's just an amendment. Iowa is one of just a few states that has no protection of the right to keep and bear arms in the state constitution. And so that's something that we are interested in, and we think Iowans are as well.
Okay. One of the things I've been watching is the fetal heartbeat bill that you guys passed last year's obviously been, it's facing a court challenge. I am not optimistic about how, you know, eventually when this gets to the Iowa Supreme Court, how they're going to rule based on what they did to the waiting period on abortions. They seem to be kind of setting up their position on abortion and how they're going to protect Roe v. Wade. My question is, I know a lot of people I talk to are frustrated with our process of judicial selection because it seems like it favors the left, as well as there's too much influence by the Iowa Bar Association. A lot of people aren't aware of how the Constitution requires what it says about the makeup of those judicial nominating commissions, as well as, you know, simple fact, you guys, you know, the Senate, I don't think a lot of people aren't aware that the Senate doesn't get to, you know, confirm any of these judicial appointments. Do you think it's time for Iowa to perhaps, you know, adopt the federal system of judicial selection and confirmation?
There is a lot of talk about the Judicial Nominating Commission and how we select judges in the state of Iowa. And it's not just within the last year. This is a multi-frustration, maybe a multi-decade frustration.
I've been complaining about it since 2009. So
it's not just a new phenomenon as far as one case or one decision we don't like. It's a culmination of many, many years of frustration with the courts legislating from the bench. And so any discussion has to start with that premise. And as you know, our Judicial Nominating Commission is constitutional. It's something that's in the Constitution. And so in order to change it, you have two options. You can either change the Constitution or you can change the process within the confines of what the Constitution says. And so we're still looking at that option to see what options we have as far as keeping the constitutional language as it is, but changing the makeup and trying to see what that may look like. But there is no doubt that the bar has a lot of power when it comes to selecting judges. Just so the listeners know, there's 16 members of the Judicial Nominating Commission, at least at the Supreme Court level. Eight of those are selected by the governor and are confirmed by the Senate. So those are citizens that are not attorneys. But eight are selected by only attorneys. Only attorneys can vote on those. And they are not subject to confirmation. So essentially the members of the bar, and I'm not talking about the bar association, there is a difference. The members of the bar who are licensed to practice in the state of Iowa, they get to pick the eight they want. And so it's a fairly undemocratic process when you really think about it, that only lawyers get to decide that whole entire half of the nominating commission.
Well, and that's chaired by the Chief Justice, at least.
Yeah, and that's the final point is, They have the most senior judge chair it. And so you have essentially nine people making the decision that are attorneys and eight that are not attorneys. And so taking a look at that and seeing what options may be out there, I think, as we just talked about, changing the Constitution is very hard and it takes a long time. I think the first step is to look within the current language in the Constitution and see what changes could possibly be made that fit within those constraints.
Good deal. Okay, religious liberty. I was disappointed that Religious Freedom Restoration Act that just died last year. And from the landscape of what I see both nationally as well as potentially even within the state of Iowa, you know, we've even had a couple cases where sexual orientation, gender identity laws in our case, or Iowa Civil Rights Act has been used as a, you know, I think a club of against business owners who want to exercise their religious faith in their business by not discriminating against people, but not by not wanting to participate with a particular event. For instance, you know, I guess the main thing that on my mind is same-sex marriage ceremonies. Is this something that the Iowa Senate can actually pass this year? And what are some of the barriers to this?
Well, there's no doubt there are some in our caucus that make this a top priority, and then there's some that still have a lot of questions about it. And so there's definitely a mixed view within the caucus, and so we'll continue to feel out where the caucus wants to go on that. But right now, I think it's really a messaging issue, and you need to continue to work with, you know, the business community is largely against it, so you need to continue to work with them and figure out their concerns before moving forward with anything.
Right, and it's been mind-boggling. I guess some of the people in the business community I call fremenies because they're with me on some issues, but on like, you know, Common Core and RFRA. They've been against, and it's been mind-boggling to me how they've kind of adopted some of this stuff. But moving on, I'm asking to weigh in on that. I know you have to work with those folks. Medicaid. There's Medicaid privatization was a huge issue during the 2018, especially the governor's race, but also legislative races. Are there any plans to address some of the concerns that people have about Medicaid? And how can the system be improved?
Yes, our job is to always watch Medicaid and do the best we can to make sure that it's working for not only the people that use Medicaid services, but also for the taxpayers who are footing the bill. And our role is largely oversight and making sure that the system is working for our constituents and our constituent taxpayers. The big question the legislature needs to decide is, do we want to pass restrictions and put them into law, or do we want to throw out ideas and work with the governor to put those in the Medicaid contracts? And that's what happened largely last session, is the legislature worked on some areas that we think would improve the system. It's, you know, things like requiring the providers to be paid within a certain amount of time. But instead of putting that in law, we worked with the governor to get those in the contracts so that we don't continue to add to the Iowa code and negotiate from the legislature as opposed to negotiate those contracts with the MCOs. But there is frustration with the process not working as well as we want, although it has gotten tremendously better But also the escalating costs of Medicaid. We found out just this week we're asking for $140 million supplemental towards the current year budget. That's more than the rest of the new spending we had last year almost of everything in state government. And so we need to continue to control the costs, but also continue to make sure the program is working for those that use it.
Okay. Education spending, that's something that's kind of a drumbeat that we keep on hearing, especially in that we've seen other states with strikes. Teachers aren't getting paid enough. We need to spend more on education. What is the Iowa legislature planning, or at least the Iowa Senate Republicans planning on doing on addressing education spending? And do you think that teachers aren't getting paid enough?
I am very proud of our record on education here in the state of Iowa. We have the 8th highest paid teachers in the country. We've added over $700 million to the system since I've been elected and since Governor Branstad came back. We have some of the highest test scores in the country. We have up and down the stats, we are doing very well. And so the big thing with education funding is we need to make sure as a legislature that when we commit a certain amount of money to education funding, it is an amount that is sustainable for the long term. And what happened over and over and over again when Democrats were in control of this state was they promised a giant amount of money to these schools. And when it came time to actually write them the check, they didn't have the money. And so they told these school districts, you know what, you can spend it, but we're not going to give it to you. And so that left the schools with two options. They could either lay off teachers midway through the year, which is a horrible option, or they could raise property taxes, which is a horrible option as well. And because of the mismanagement, the overpromise, underdeliver attitude that the Democrats had while in charge, it caused a tremendous amount of problems here in the state of Iowa. And so what we've done is said we are going to commit an amount of money, and we are 100% going to fund it no matter what. And even in our tough deappropriation years where the estimates came in below what we expected and we had to cut budgets in the middle of the year, even though education is over half of our budget, or almost half of our budget, about 45% K through 12 education, we didn't cut a dollar. We kept that promise that we had made in K-12. And so I am proud of our record on education, and we're going to continue to fund at a level that's sustainable for the long term.
So as far as education funding is concerned, one of the things I've noticed is that, I noticed that we are increasing, we have increased education spending, but I have to wonder whether school districts are spending the money well. Obviously, Waukee's got a glaring example this year of fiscal mismanagement. But also, too, it seems like the non-teaching staff ratio to teacher ratio keeps on, shrinking. Do you think school districts need to address how they're staffed, maybe cut away some of the middle management, perhaps that way they can actually hire more teachers?
Well, some of those issues you brought up are definitely issues at the local level. The situation.
Oh, right.
That situation in Waukee is 100% on them and their school board and their failure to provide oversight, along with the county attorney that failed to prosecute when he knew this was happening. It took a new county attorney to actually bring charges. And so that was, without a doubt, 100% failure at the local level. The other hand, I would say not all the spending problems and the financial problems come from the local level. For decades, we have run education from Des Moines with an iron fist, telling schools what, we're going to give you a pot of money and you can only spend it on this thing. And we're going to give you this pot of money and you can only spend it on this thing. Well, the problem with that is all the school districts in the state are different. Ankeny that I represent is much different than Grinnell where I grew up, and it's different than Montezuma, and it's different from Greene County schools. They're all different. And yet we've ruled them exactly the same for decades from Des Moines. And what we've tried to do the last 2 years is say, we're going to allocate this amount of money that we think is sustainable for the long term in new educational money. But the other thing we're going to do, which I think is just as important, is we're going to give the local school boards more discretion on how they spend that money, because the challenges and opportunities in Ankeny are much different than Grinnell. And those school boards need to be able to spend the money that we send them in a way that best serves their students. For example, we have programs like the teacher leadership program that we passed several years ago. There are schools that are just fighting to keep their doors open, and we're telling them you have to spend more money on teacher leadership. Well, maybe that's not the best option for some of those schools. And so we want to give more flexibility for those schools. With local control comes problems sometimes, right? I mean, we elect our school board members to oversee our school board. And when they fail, like they did in Waukee in that example, you know, that's part of local control. And so it's a double-edged sword. But in general, we believe those things sort themselves out. And it's going to sort itself out in Waukee. It took far longer than it probably should have. And it might take an election or two that, you know, elections will have consequences on that. But if you're going to be for local control, you also have to deal with some of the results of bad decisions at the local level.
Right. So school choice, are you guys going to take any action on school choice this year?
Our caucus is very pro school choice, and so we're always looking at options to get more students in the educational setting they think is appropriate for them. And so I know there's several in our caucus that want to continue to push on educational savings account. There's some that don't think that will work for their districts they represent. So it's another issue that we're just going to have to continue to talk about and work out with our caucus and with the House and the governor.
Okay. And the Des Moines Register keeps it. I'm waiting for them to drop their first op-ed of the year on, you know, basically complaining about private and independent instruction. Is that something, independent private instruction, excuse me, for homeschoolers? Are you guys going to entertain any bills that will challenge or that will, I guess, redefine what that looks like and address some of the issues that the Register and others have brought up, or are we going to just keep it the same?
Well, I never have and never will take my marching orders from the Des Moines Register. So
that's good to hear.
We have the Register has not approved of a lot of the things that we've done over the last couple of years. But you know what? It's really hard to argue with the results that we've gotten, though. I mean, we're ranked number one in the country by nonpartisan third-party groups. And so they might not agree with the path to get there, but it's hard to deny the fact that we are there. So we're not going to let the Des Moines Register dictate what we legislate down here.
Okay, last question. This is the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. What's your favorite caffeinated drink?
Monster energy drink, for sure. I'll tell you this, I've never liked coffee, but
you're breaking my heart.
3 days ago, I started to like coffee, so my wife's trying to push it on me, so we'll see if I can pick up that habit. But
you right start now, so 3 days ago, this change occurred. What sparked this?
I don't know. My wife was making coffee, and I said, you know what, I'll try some today. And I guess it was 4 days ago. It was Monday, so I'm 4 days into my coffee habit. I still don't like the taste, but I've drank it every day.
Okay, well, I have. I'm
the feeling it's probably better long term for my heart than the Monster Energy, so maybe that's the impetus to try the coffee, but I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. I think coffee's definitely better than Monster Energy drink, and you just need to find the right beans, Jack, and. You know, I suggest cold brew. I make cold brew at home, and actually, if you do cold brew and you keep it brewed for, you know, you let it brew for a long time, like at least I usually do at least a day. I mean, it's even more caffeinated than the stuff you know French press or your coffee maker at home. So anyway, my suggestion. But hey, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Look forward to seeing what you guys do this session, and have a Merry Christmas.
It's always fun. Thank you. Have a Merry Christmas yourself. Bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please make sure to go check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's Caffeinated Thoughts, CAFFEINTED Thoughts. .com, or you could just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our emails, that way you don't miss a single update. We'd also appreciate it if you subscribe to the podcast. You can do that on Podbean, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts. If you happen to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating. I would really appreciate that. Also, we're on Google Play. If there's a podcast service or app that we're not on, you know, you can drop me a line at shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com, and I can see if I can make that happen. So hopefully you'd subscribe. Definitely check out the website. Most of all, friends, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Hey, this is Shane Vanderhart, and until next time, take care.